Hello and welcome to the EMG Health Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Jonathan Sakia, and today I'm delighted to welcome my guest, Professor Lee Charvet. I first met Lee a few years ago to discuss a research collaboration relating to some work I was doing with a non-invasive neuromodulation device for multiple sclerosis, and I was immediately struck by how smart, warm, and kind she was. So I'm really looking forward to this conversation. Lee serves as professor in the Department of Neurology at New York University Grossman School of Medicine and works at the New York Langone Medical Center as a clinical neuropsychologist, and she also serves as director of multiple sclerosis, or MS, research. Lee was born in Memphis, Tennessee, and obtained her bachelor's in psychology from the University of Michigan in Ann Arbor, her master's in clinical psychology, and then her PhD, both from Vanderbilt University in Nashville, Tennessee, which is known, by the way, as Music City and home to the renowned Grand Ole Opry, which, funnily enough, does not feature opera, rather country, bluegrass, and gospel music. After her PhD, she served as an intern at the Veteran Administration's Hospital at Yale in Connecticut, and then as a fellow at Stony Brook out on New York's Long Island. Lee is a dedicated teacher, helping many practitioners understand her world, and she personally runs two fellowships. She's a very active researcher, holds many grants, and has been a prolific author of peer-reviewed articles, multiple abstracts, presentations, and book chapters, and is a sought-after speaker. She's been active in many professional medical organizations, served editorial functions for journals, and has been a frequent guest in the media, answering medical questions and generally raising awareness. Throughout her education and after, Lee's resume reflects honor after honor after honor. She is clearly one very smart lady. And she's also a very nice lady. And quite fitting for her time in Nashville, one visitor to her lab was Dolly Parton. I wonder what she made of Lee's work. And she also tells me that her main hobby, not Dolly Parton's, Lee's main hobby, is her three teenagers, and that's her full-time job. And my guess is that having expertise in psychology comes in pretty handy with three teenagers in the house. So, Professor Lee Charvet, welcome.
Oh, well, thanks so much for having me, and what a wonderful introduction. I really appreciate the opportunity to come and speak with you.
You're very welcome, Lee. And, you know, going through your CV, I could have talked for probably 40 minutes. It's an amazing, amazing resume.
Oh, you're too kind.
My late dad had a great expression. He said, if you want stuff done, give it to the busy people. So I'd like to start with, you know, I'm always fascinated by what takes people from one place to another. You started in Memphis, Tennessee. You crossed the Mason-Dixon line to go to the University of Michigan. And then you headed back down south again to Nashville and then back north again to New York. So what led to those jaunts? And please tell our non-American listeners about the differences between the north and the south of the United States.
Well, it's funny that you picked up on that, the regional differences, because you're exactly right that it seemed like much bigger of a deal than it is now. I guess in this globalization and Starbucks is everywhere, the regional differences in the United States are not as pronounced. But back then, especially from my upbringing, my parents were from the Deep South. And so I was very much this is a Southern culture and identity. And so it seemed like I was going north or shifting into a whole different world and a whole different region just by leaving, you know, the state lines a little bit and going a little bit north to the Midwest. The way I arrived at University of Michigan was pretty random, a teenage story where I just, I very much wanted to go somewhere else. It was the only school I applied to. It was Rolling Admissions. I got in and I had never been. And I feel incredibly lucky because what a wonderful experience I had and what a wonderful school. And after that, again, randomness, the doctoral programs that I were looking at were few and far between, so I had to apply at the national level. And again, it brought me right back south with Vanderbilt in Nashville. And not my intent. I really, at that point, wasn't choosing based on anything due to geography, but just opportunity for study. And so that brought me back to Nashville, which again, very fortunate because Nashville is a wonderful place and it was a wonderful, I had a wonderful experience with all my education. Those are some of the reasons that I bounced around.
I not too long ago visited with a good friend who moved to Nashville. He's lived in many places, and he said it's the best place he's ever lived. Very, very vibrant place. And it isn't just country music. I have to be honest and say that's not my favorite form of music, but a lot of good other forms of music there. So in addition to your clinical and academic work, Lee, you've done scientific affairs liaison tasks with Ortho McNeil and Janssen. What did that involve? And for healthcare practitioners who aren't familiar with those jobs, how does one get into such work?
Yeah, so I started from my fellowship. I joined the faculty in the neurology department at Stony Brook, and with a research focus. And again, I don't mean to continue the theme of somewhat randomness, but I think we all experience life just kind of shows you the direction. And so one of my colleagues left to join industry, and I was intrigued, and I, for a variety of reasons, I thought that this type of position, it was just very appealing. These were newer positions at the time where they were hiring people through medical affairs, and it's really grown, this kind of scientific liaison. There's many different names for it, but it's based out of the medical affairs versus the commercial side of pharmaceutical companies. And the role is to learn the science and to convey the science and help guide direction and development. And so and these were all under Johnson & Johnson, so Johnson & Johnson's pharmaceutical division. And again, a tremendous learning opportunity just to see that side of the world, which is completely different than academia, and learned a great deal about drug development and got to meet all kinds of wonderful people all over the world. However, I am one of the rare people who actually comes back to academia after going to industry. Really my true love is working directly with patients and developing research questions and working with the team. And so I just over time greatly missed that opportunity. And so I went back to Stony Brook, and together with the MS Center there, we all moved here to NYU.
Well, let's dig down into multiple sclerosis. And before I ask you my first question about it, you know, there's the old joke about the medical students who's in his or her final exam and is asked by the examiner, "What causes Crohn's disease?" And the kid vacillates, and it's like, "Oh gosh, you know, I was just reading about this Crohn's disease, etiology, Crohn's disease." And after a few minutes of shifting from foot to foot, the rather pathetic young man says to the teacher, "I'm so sorry, I've forgotten." And that leads the eminence grise to say, "Amazing, the only person in the world who knew, and he's forgotten." So with that setup, what's the current state of knowledge about the cause of multiple sclerosis?
Oh, gosh. Well, you know, what a frustrating journey, because we know so much about MS, and MS has been with us and diagnosed for really hundreds of years now. And we still don't know what the cause is. That's because it's a complex set of factors. So it involves the immune system. There's a lot of epidemiology based study and factors, including geographic and environmental factors. There's a genetics role.
Largely northern climes, northern.
Yeah, right. So the geographic gradient, for sure. And again, this is in large scale, and that's been tied to the ongoing vitamin D story. Vitamin D seems to play a very important role, and low vitamin D is a risk, and maybe that explains at least part of the geographic gradient story. But it's again just not clear, and I think it's just because there's so many contributing factors to the risk. And then, so there's the risk that people carry, and then there's something that triggers it. And that comes to the viruses as well. So people who are likely at risk for MS in the first place have a higher rate of onset of MS after certain infections.
So I know that one of the thoughts is that, you know, is it an infection or is that just uncovering a flaw in the immune system?
Correct.
Now, as I was reading your CV, Lee, I noticed you've done a fair amount around pediatric MS. I didn't even know that was a thing, because, I actually have some friends with the disease, but I always thought it of being a disease that primarily presents in youngish women, of fair complexion, but kids?
Yeah, so the MS, people living with MS are much more diverse than the standard image that comes to mind, just as you mentioned. And so it really affects almost all of the population, including younger people. And so MS was, you're exactly right, maybe a little less than 20 years ago, even thought to be exclusively a disease of adults, with a younger adult age of onset on average. However, pediatric MS became a characterized subpopulation of the MS patient population when children with presentation that was clearly MS were finally starting to be diagnosed and linked into what were previously completely adult-focused MS centers. And so pediatric MS has become much more readily identified and characterized now. I think that there's an ongoing discussion of whether pediatric MS represents a unique presentation of MS, or is it just the earlier window of MS that we're picking up? So for instance, I work with many people every day living with MS, and if you listen to their stories, often they had the initial attack or onset, especially in teenage years, and it was just completely missed. And so maybe this is just the earlier window and we're picking up now what we've always known about MS. It's just that now we're able to detect and identify that that's occurring earlier or younger in the patient's life. But yes, it's a very interesting story. And so there's differences about how it affects children as well as, offering a window into the earliest onset.
And I think, you're right. It's a lot of things where people say, well, there's an increased incidence. Is that just because we're more alert, more aware, and have better, and we'll come on to diagnosis in a minute. But how does it behave in kids?
Right. So it's really interesting, and studies are catching up. But it's interesting from the neurodevelopmental perspective in that this is a demyelinating condition occurring in the context of acute myelination or brain development. And so we know in children that they are pediatric patients, they have more frequent relapses, so they have more attacks, but they also have much more robust recovery, which we would expect with the resilience of a younger nervous system. So those are, and they're almost all exclusively relapsing remitting with subtype of MS. It's very unusual to have a pediatric onset of a progressive subtype.
That's interesting. So let's move on a little bit. What are the latest and greatest criteria and modalities to confirm or refute an MS diagnosis? Because I'll mention a friend of mine a bit later on in our chat who's dealt with the disease, and he almost certainly had his first presentation in his early 20s, and it was visual disturbance, and it was missed. So what are people doing nowadays to try and tie down the diagnosis?
Yeah, so a lot of, and that's a very common story, is that those first attacks are missed or they didn't meet diagnostic criteria. So the general idea still, and it's been consistent, is that for a diagnosis, it's a clinical diagnosis. So it's based on having two clinical attacks disseminated in time and space. And that's pretty much the defining criteria. The McDonald criteria is pretty much the standard. It was revised in 2017 to really reflect or to continue to keep up to date with all of the advanced neuroimaging techniques. And that's really where we're having the advances for diagnosis. And what neuroimaging provides us is to date the attacks. And so you can see prior lesions very clearly in addition to the newer lesions. And that, so in the context of one presenting visit, you're able to establish a diagnosis of MS versus previously we would wait and make, after one clinical attack and one lesion, we would wait and see if we weren't able to pick up the historical lesions. And so that's the advance with diagnoses for our clinic right now, is really the advances in neuroimaging.
So similarly, what's happening with treatment regimes? I remember the old ABC drugs, Avonex, Betaseron, and Copaxone. Where are we up to in the alphabet now? I'm guessing there's far more drugs.
Yes, so that's been an area of rapid development. We are up to Z, although some of the letters aren't all, not all letters are represented. I think there's that we have 21 drugs now. So pretty much every letter is represented. And so the drugs you mentioned are in the injectable class. So the drugs largely vary in terms of route of administration. We have oral medications now, which is a big relief for many patients because the injectables are very difficult for a lot of people. And then the newer therapies in particular are infusion-based. And so these are infusions that patients typically do, for instance, every 6 months or so.
And these are the disease-modifying drugs, right?
Aiming correct,
to
yeah.
Control the effect. But then again, you also have a range of drugs to treat symptoms like wakefulness or issues with gait. There's one drug for that, isn't there?
Yes.
But what are some of the other symptoms that have been specifically targeted for MS?
Yeah, so that's an important point, is that the disease-modifying drugs are largely, there are now some approved for the progressive subtype, but they're largely developed and indicated for use in relapsing remitting subtype, which is typically the earlier presentation of the disease, and trying to quiet the disease activity. And with the goal, which is still not clearly met, of delaying transition to progression. So most patients present as relapsing remitting, I think about 85%, which is where you have an acute attack, relative recovery, another acute attack, relative recovery. And then over time, patients typically transition to what's called secondary progressives. And that's where you have just gradual ongoing neurologic decline. So the goal is to delay that and also to quiet the attacks. So what the drugs miss with that is that they're not very effective or effective at all, really, in repair or recovery of function, and they don't treat symptoms. So because of the nature of MS, the saying is, if you've met one person living with MS, you've met one person living with MS, because it can affect people so broadly and so differently, really throughout the entire CNS. So that's a very broad range of symptoms, as you mentioned, everything from motor impairment, gait and balance dysfunction, upper extremity impairments, to cognitive symptoms, fatigue, mood disturbance, pain. There's all kinds of symptoms. And every patient has to then rely on symptomatic therapies, which can include drugs or other types of therapies. And that's really where our focus is, because that the symptom burden in MS is really what dictates the quality of life or the burden of disease. And while disease-modifying therapies are wonderful, they don't really address that symptom burden for a patient.
Yeah, and we'll definitely come on to that. But I want to sort of move sideways. You've talked about neurological symptoms, issues with gait and so on and so forth, vision, but neuropathic pain. But I know that you've done work in cognitive recovery for multiple sclerosis patients. Can you tell us a bit about that, please?
Yeah, sure. So I'm a clinical neuropsychologist, so cognition is a main area of interest for me. And so the majority of people living with MS have some degree of cognitive impairment, but it's very different than what we would think of, typically very different than what we would think of in terms of like an age-related dementia or something progressive or global. It's subtle. So it's typically, on average, a mild decline in information processing speed. But for a younger adult in particular who has the demands of work and home, it can be quite disabling. And so really, a lot of my work has been focused on trying to detect that at its earliest point and see if we can do treatments that can remediate or improve the experience of that cognitive impairment. And so because of the nature of the slowed information processing speed, I early on became quite interested in what we're familiar with as brain training games. And so these are adaptive, interactive, web-based training programs that really drive learning, particularly focused on that gateway or information processing part of things. And we found in a large clinical trial that they do help. And so we're really trying to optimize that use of different types of remediations that can help the larger segment of people with cognitive impairment.
So I guess the central message, based on the last couple of topics we've discussed is that patients living with multiple sclerosis really need to be at a center that has expertise in all aspects of the management of their chronic conditions so that they can get the best possible care. Fair comment?
Oh, very fair comment, especially with the rapidly evolving treatment landscape. I think that that is at the time of diagnosis and preferably to get the diagnosis to go to an MS specialist in an MS care center for sure.
Fantastic. So another sort of moving on from cognitive work, I'm a recent convert to the value of mindfulness. And I must admit, having been a bit of a curmudgeon about it, I dismissed it as a bunch of California woo-woo. You know, it was like, this is crazy stuff. And then I attended a talk by an amazing neuropsychologist, almost as amazing as you, Lee. And then heard a fellow surgeon telling me about how it had changed her life. And I was really, really impressed with, and I do my best to practice it. But can you describe the role that mindfulness plays in the therapeutic armamentarium for MS patients?
Sure. I share your journey to mindfulness from skeptic to embracing it and incredibly impressed with how profoundly it can affect really every aspect of day-to-day functioning, including cognition. Mindfulness is very powerful in practice, like I said, for both emotional and cognitive health. And so clinically, I broadly recommend it to everybody living with MS and kind of in general to everybody. And I think that the research really supports, a brief practice as kind of, you know, you look at minimal because behavior change and adopting these kind of things is so difficult. So really 10 minutes a day, if that's consistent, can really result in pretty profound benefit over time. And so addressing emotional health improves cognitive functioning for sure, and I think has that broader effect across all aspects of functioning. So I share, you know, your enthusiasm, and it really everything we recommend or is evidence based, and the evidence is pretty impressive with the use of mindfulness in across disease and in healthy people too.
And I've got a friend who's been doing work in mindfulness based stress reduction in troop preparedness. But the surgeon who told me about it was fascinating. What she said was, close your eyes and imagine the most complex procedure you've ever done and imagine the most trying component of that procedure. And I had a very clear picture in my mind as she said that. And she's after about 10 or 15 seconds, she said, open your eyes. Ask yourself the question, what else were you thinking about? And it was like, well, nothing. I was focused on, you know, dissecting this tumor off the vena cava, and not, you know, not killing the patient. And it's just that simple. And it's simple things like if you're having a cup of coffee, you know, really focusing on, and you know, the feel of the warmth of the cup in your hands, the aroma of the coffee, the taste of the coffee, and just focus on that instead of what we normally do, which is just glug it down while multitasking and not really paying attention to anything. So for any of you who are listening who haven't tried it, it isn't nonsense. It does work. So there we go. Yeah. So in another therapeutic area, you've been very active deploying and studying transcranial direct current stimulation technology for MS patients. Can you give us a high-level perspective on where this fits in and how it and similar therapies help?
Yeah, well, sure. This brings us back to the trial of the brain training games that I was mentioning where we did find benefit. I wanted to point out also that that trial was done at home with what we call remote supervision. So we in real time monitored our participants playing the games and connected with them in that way. But the treatment delivery was at home. And through that, I realized immediately the power and the need way before COVID to reach people with these repeated therapeutics, or when I say repeated, meaning daily practice in their home at their convenience. And so I was brought into the world of non-invasive brain stimulation and transcranial direct current stimulation, in particular TDCS, to see if I could pair the stimulation with the brain training games to boost the benefit. So maybe to potentiate the benefit, to have to play it less, or to get a greater benefit and more lasting benefit from the training. And so that's brought us into the world of the use of TDCS. And we immediately realized to study this, we needed to go at home. So we developed a pretty extensive protocol to remotely supervise TDCS to our patients at home for treatment, and pair it now with either cognitive or motor training, depending on the targeted symptom. We also pair it with mindfulness. So we really use it and are studying it largely, but we have a clinical service as well, where we're just trying to optimize the use of TDCS in that way.
And what sort of results did you see? You saw that using TDCS in combination with brain training or brain training exercises or mindfulness. Did you see that there was a clinically significant advantage?
Yes. So I think it's consistent with the literature that is really what we call functional targeting, is when you apply the stimulation to the region of interest that you're engaging with the training, you can have increased benefit, increased learning through long-term potentiation. And so you get improved or boost rehab outcomes. And so we have seen that in all of our preliminary trials, treating cognitive impairment, treating gait and balance issues. And we have large confirmatory clinical trials that are underway or near completion right now, really just to try to understand and optimize the treatment. But I do think that there's a great deal of promise there. I also think, in particular, when you mentioned mindfulness, I think it's probably the most robust evidence for the use of brain stimulation therapeutics in general, and TDCS as well, is with the treatment of depression, which is a pretty broad category if you consider maybe stress reduction. And then also that brings us into fatigue, so these symptoms. And so we found a significant benefit for the treatment of fatigue in our pilot study, and our trying to confirm that now in a large clinical trial, and also the mood benefit. And that's where we can pair it with mindfulness. So we for many reasons, we like to pair the stimulation with an ongoing training or activity for consistent brain state and for that functional targeting for best benefit.
Well, we'll have to get you back when these trials are finished to update us. But you mentioned supervising people from home, and I noticed that you've become an out-of-state telehealth provider for Florida. Again, your eyes are drifting to the south.
Yeah. Well, yeah, but that's tele, so I remote, and so that's so I, because of my research with telehealth now for over 10 years, the telerehabilitation, reaching people living in their home. We early on, actually before, again, COVID is such a major marker for telehealth and the access and availability of it. But before, so I say pre-COVID, NYU through Innovative Care has allowed us to have a telehealth TDCS service where we clinically work with people to provide them the at-home brain stimulation paired with therapeutic activity. And so in that, we really have been overwhelmed by people living all over the United States, truthfully all over the world, wanting that remote access. And so the Florida telehealth part is through that clinical service.
Well, it strikes me that, we've all had to make accommodations during this pandemic. And I know a lot of clinicians have found that, hang on a second, this is actually better than what we did in the past. And a friend who's a psychiatrist actually in New York City told me that his experience was that it's actually in many ways better, because a lot of people who just, they can't get out the house, either, because of their psychological issues, they may not be able to come and see a doctor or either a psychiatrist or a clinical psychologist, and that telehealth provides opportunities to do that. He also said to me that, there are nuances of human behavior that you can't get over a Zoom call. What are your thoughts on all of that?
Well, I think that's exactly right. And I would add nuances of live social interaction that I think we're all acutely aware of after what we've all lived through. So I especially, again, I come from the place of having to deliver, you know, I think all the treatments, the symptomatic treatments really require, you know, daily repeated practice. And so you absolutely need to enable people to have access to that remotely and at home. And I think that from a clinical standpoint, to be able to reach people, you always need that option. And I think that that's, and it facilitates a lot of appointments that otherwise wouldn't, or connection provider contact that otherwise would not have happened. But I do think that there should be a hybrid model where there's something about live connection, real time in person connection with a patient that for many reasons, for diagnostic reasons, as you mentioned, but also just that connection and communication, which is good for everybody. And so I just we need that as the cornerstone of our practice. And then I think the remote to support and continue. And also, of course, for emergencies and that kind of thing, you can't beat teleconnection.
Well, I concur with everything you said. And, you know, I'm sure everyone, not just physicians or clinical practitioners, are looking forward to a brave new world. So you've mentioned COVID. You've been involved with the International Consortium on Neuromodulation for COVID-19, or ICNC. Everything's got to have an abbreviation, hasn't it? Yeah. What results are you seeing, Lee?
Yeah, so that's just a broad group. So when you think about treatments for acute COVID illness, there's a story there for the use of certain types of non-invasive stimulation therapeutics, from vagal nerve stimulation to transcranial direct current stimulation, and anywhere in between. And so that it was just a group thinking about how can we apply this now, or evaluate this now to treat acute COVID illness. So that was probably the original mission. However, TDCS has a very, in particular, many brain stimulation therapeutics, non-invasive, have a very large, well-established record of symptomatic treatment across conditions. For instance, symptoms such as fatigue, such as cognitive slowing, or what we would call, people often refer to as brain fog, for pain. And so we look at the people now who have this post-acute COVID syndrome, which is still being defined and understood, but clearly a large segment of people after acute COVID illness have persisting symptoms. And there may be a tie-in between the symptomatic benefits of using TDCS, in particular the non-invasive brain stimulation therapeutics, to help boost and recover their function. And so through our clinical service, actually, we have several people now who have use this for the treatment to assist in their recovery. And we've had really, this is clinical, but very strong benefit, helping two people to return to work and feeling much better.
I guess my next question is a bit of a shameless plug. I know that you're finalizing work on the textbook of neuropsychology with a focus on multiple sclerosis. I've been involved in writing a few books and know what a labor of love that can be. Can you tease us about what the book is? And then after you get a chance to read it, we'll have you back and we can talk.
Yeah, oh my gosh. Well, I think that, I winced when you said finalizing. that would be a stretch by far. So certainly a labor of love, and really enthusiastic about there's so much development and application, particularly within neuropsychology and the intersection of everything we've just spoken about as far as cognitive functioning and emotional and brain health. But that is under, I would definitely say still in progress. So I'll clearly keep you posted, but yes, not ready, not near finalizing yet.
Okay, well, I think it took me 2 years to finalize.
It's quite a bit of work. Yeah, I'm impressed.
It's a phenomenal amount of work. And if you edit a book and you have contributors, the one lesson that you learn very quickly is if you need their manuscript by the end of June, right, tell them you need it the end of January.
Yeah.
There's a chance. But what always gets me is that you spend 2 years writing it, And the same thing with peer-reviewed manuscripts. You send it to the journal and you get the galley proofs and you're told you've got 12 hours to return them. I never got that, never understood it. Well, finally, Lee, I love to ask all my guests this question. So you go into your lab tomorrow, open a cupboard, and out pops a genie and gives you 3 wishes to improve human health. What would those wishes be?
Oh, gosh. I've come, just like we talked about with our movement towards embracing mindfulness, my prior self may wince at what comes to mind, but the first thing is absolutely diet. If we look for evidence-based treatments, a healthy diet, a brain health forward diet has such profound effects, both on neurologic illness and disease and recovery, but in general health across the board, that it's just frustrating that it requires so much behavioral change, which is so difficult to adopt and really reap the benefit from. But I think absolutely diet for optimal health. A second thing would be, tying into our mindfulness discussion, but stress reduction. I see over and over, I think that stress, overwhelming stress in particular, in the history of trauma, has really makes us so vulnerable to illness and how illness affects us, that the wear and tear of stress really, I think, complicates our physical health by quite a bit, and we're really not able to address that now. So I think interventions and really buffering from those effects would be have a very great impact. I think you said 3.
I said 3.
I think about what I see day to day as far as what I would like to remove, what I see cause pain for people. Right. And so I think the third thing might be alcohol.
You want some.
Yeah. Well, see, that's the thing. It's a double-edged sword. Right. But at the clinical level, the absolute destruction towards both health and life and function that alcohol can do for some people, it's truly staggering. And so I think to have a tool for all of these to be able to remove and reduce and I think that gets at the issue, is that all of this requires really powerful behavioral change and consistent behavioral change, which is so, so difficult, especially when you're in pain already. And so that really, in my genie cabinet, is something that would facilitate and help people to have access to those benefits, or to flip a switch to have those benefits without having to go through the struggle and obstacles that behavioral change represents for us.
Yeah. And I know that to change behaviors, you have to change beliefs. So maybe you need to go to the lab and have a conversation with the genie.
Yeah.
Well, Professor Lee Charvet, thanks so much for taking the time to be with us today and for all you do to increase our understanding of what is a wretched disease, and for all you do for those living with MS. You know, my dear friend Montel Williams has said that he has MS, but MS doesn't have him. And with you on the side of science, Montel and all the others with MS are better off. So Lee, thank you.
Oh, thanks so much for having me. It's just wonderful to speak to you. And yes, and I very much appreciate your closing with that statement, because that's absolutely true.
Well, I have to say, from the first time I met you, just such a delight to talk to you. Mate, you have this happiness in your voice that just comes across, and it's truly infectious. Well, folks, that's it for today. Please check out all the prior podcasts in the archive and join us next time for the EMG podcast. Until then, stay safe, stay well, stay curious. Bye for now.